Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Around Illinois, people continue turning out to demand justice over last week's killing of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis. A demonstration in downtown Urbana drew hundreds of people, including the Urbana mayor, police chief, and director of the public health district. The protesters packed intersections and took a knee in solidarity with Floyd.
A lot of people are dealing with uncertainty and fear for the first time during the pandemic. We're out here in solidarity with people who live that every day.
That was CU Public Health Director Julie Pride. Thanks to Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines for that audio. In recent days, protests also took place in Aurora, Bloomington Normal, Chicago, Edwardsville, and Peoria, among other places. That also includes Springfield, which is where this voice memo is from.
My name is Sunshine Clemens, and I am a co-founder and the president of our local Black Lives Matter chapter here in Springfield, Illinois. On Sunday, May 31st, we just had an extraordinarily successful solidarity procession. It was estimated that roughly 3,000 cars and, let's say, 9,000 people participated. We chose to have a solidarity event in that manner because of the coronavirus situation and the pandemic that we are currently working through. Everyone, I think, knows that the Black community has been hit the hardest by the virus, and we wanted to offer people a way to still let their voice be heard and stand in solidarity with all the victims of the police brutality and situations that are going on across the country. But we wanted to offer them a way to do so that would make them feel safe and allow them to be socially distanced and not feel that they were putting themselves or anyone that they may come in contact with at risk. And I think it was extremely successful with 3,000 cars. We definitely underestimated the turnout for the event, and we had to extend our procession route on the fly to try to unclog some of the traffic jams that happened because so many people turned out. It's important to stand with your community through whatever the situation may be, whether it's lack of opportunities, senseless killings, systemic racism, a pandemic, whatever it is. You stand and you work together and you make the needed changes no matter how long that takes. You do the work. That's what Black Lives Matter is about and represents to me. And I think people have been receptive of it. I don't think it would be possible for me to come off the heels of a event that had 3,000 cars and roughly 9,000 people that participated and say that we don't have some support out there. It was made very clear that we do. There are, of course, those who are, you know, staunchly against what we do, but progress is almost always met with resistance, so that's not really a surprise to us, and it's not going to stop us. Our goal is to represent and empower the Black community in Springfield, as well as working toward fostering a better relationship with a variety of entities, including the police department. And that's our goal, and we'll continue to do what we can to achieve those goals, and we're always willing to work with others and collaborate on ways to achieve those goals with other organizations and people that have the same mindset and want to, you know, see the same changes that we do. It's going to take effort from all of us.
That was Springfield Black Lives Matter President Sunshine Clemens. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now, Professor Alvin Tillery. He teaches political science and African American studies at Northwestern University. There, he's also director of the Center for the Study of Diversity and Democracy. He's also the author of Between Homeland and Motherland, Africa, U.S. Foreign Policy, and Black Leadership in America. It won the W.E.B. Du Bois Distinguished Book Award from the National Conference of Black Political Scientists. Professor Tillery, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to begin by asking you about the way these protests are being framed. In the events in the last week, we've heard the words used to describe them include protest, demonstration, riot, looting. I wonder if you can just begin by talking about what do you think of the various ways we've heard the media and our political leaders framing what's been happening?
Well, I think very problematic, but also understandable. The reality is that when you have such pent-up anger in the face of longstanding injustices and inequalities, and you've kept people in stay-at-home orders for more than 2 months due to the COVID-19 pandemic, 40 million plus Americans being unemployed through the pandemic, by the way, it's not at all surprising that there will be property damage with such protests. Moreover, I like to remind Americans that we are a nation born of riotous protests. The Boston Tea Party, the famous event that is celebrated in K through 12 education, was about destroying the property of those in power. I'm not condoning it, but what I will say is that the media needs to do a better job of understanding that this is fully a part of protest dynamics. I also think that to some extent, the media and politicians of all stripes believe that protests for racial justice will only happen through peaceful frames. And that's because of the legacy, the incredibly long and powerful legacy of the African-American civil rights movement from the 1950s and 60s. But that movement was extraordinary for the tactics that it used. It was the first time in history that anyone has ever won through those tactics in America. And it's not the modal form of protest in the American tradition.
I think that's a fascinating point because in some ways, as I've seen you say before, that's an anomaly to the America's long history. I mean, we learn in our history books about tarring and feathering, the British loyalists or the royal loyalists, I guess you'd say, in the revolutionary era. And, you know, the nonviolent, protest pioneered by the civil rights movement leaders was innovative at the time, right? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. It was innovative. It was borrowed from, the Gandhian movement in India. And it was done precisely because, Miss Rosa and Dr. King and, all the leaders of that time didn't want to happen to their movement precisely what's happening today. They didn't want property damage a few outbursts of violence to be the story. They wanted their campaign for justice to be the story. And so they put on their Sunday best and they marched peacefully with signs. And I like to remind Americans that they were still met with violence, intimidation, and threats from both the state and the ordinary citizenry that they encountered. So we like to think back on, why can't they do things in the way that Dr. King and his movement did things? Well, no one loved that movement at the time that it was happening. And this is the point that I like to make. Colin Kaepernick for 3 years has been excluded from the NFL for kneeling in prayer, a stance of prayer to protest these same inequalities. And the survey research that I do shows that people were just as mad about that as they are about property damage. And so that's a real problem in America that America's got to grapple with.
And, it's interesting because it wasn't just in the South and, Bull Connor and the images that are sort of seared in our imagination and in our history books. But I mean, in Chicago, King was greeted with pretty violent resistance. I wonder if you think there is a double standard when it comes to what sort of protests are allowed based on who is doing the protesting.
I absolutely do. And again, I thank you for plugging my very old book, but more recently I've been writing a lot more about the Black Lives Matter movement and social protests and doing a lot of public opinion and quantitative analyses of these movements. And, I think that there's a lot to be said about nonviolent protest. Nonviolent protest, like the Black Lives Matter movement had with that caravan, what they do is they focus events in such a way that you can control the narrative, particularly when you're a decentralized group like Black Lives Matter that doesn't have a national figure to drive the narrative. The story does not become about looting and others. You keep the moral high ground, but we can't expect things to always play out in that way. And the point that I want to make about the multiracial crowds of young people that we see streaming into the street is that, they're tired and they're fed up and they're angry, not just about racial inequality and what happened to George Floyd, but about the fundamental breakdown of our democratic institutions and our capitalist system. And both political parties, the septuagenarian and octogenarian leaders that are in power, need to be attentive to this moment when they put forward proposals for reform. Because what this means is that they're going to have to deal with that anger in the same way, and this comes back to your point, that they respectfully deal with the anger of middle-aged and baby boomer white people who go into state capitals like in Michigan or down to the Daley Center with long guns and Confederate flags to protest wearing masks in the middle of a pandemic. The media treats those people, the politicians treat those types of protesters with reverence. Let's try to understand what they're angry about. We don't really treat the multiracial crowds of young people or the Black Lives Matter crowd or ordinary African Americans and Latinos who suffer police violence. We haven't historically treated their anger about the system with the same kind of reverence. And that's where the double standard is, and that's what needs to change.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Alvin Tillery. He's a professor of political science and African-American studies at Northwestern University. You know, I want to return to something you mentioned a moment ago, which was, and this kind of harkens back to a tweet I saw over the weekend from a Chicago Tribune columnist who said, it feels like we're living through 1918, 1929, and 1968 kind of all rolled together. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about the context of what else is happening in a society when protests reach a tipping point. I mean, we've seen regional protests in recent years over the killing of Michael Brown and Ferguson and Baltimore. And I mean, there's so many places all over the country, but I don't recall recently, at least, this sort of as massive a national sort of protest as we've had now. And in the 60s, you had Vietnam. And now we've got this pandemic and recession. Do you think that what we're seeing now would have happened without COVID-19?
It may. And I do think the Black Lives Matter organizers across the country deserve a lot of credit for raising the consciousness of, everyone by making these videos, these cell phone videos of police killings go viral. And giving us a sort of slogan for focusing our emotions about that. They deserve full credit for that. But I do think that Brian, all too well, the dominant riot history in America is a history of angry white men streaming into places like the South Side of Chicago or East St. Louis, Illinois, or Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and burning the place to the ground. Tens and hundreds of killings. And those things typically happened in summer months when people were, sort of coming out into the nature for the first time after harsh winters and mixing more. The Chicago race riot, a black kid swam across an invisible segregation line, separating white beachgoers from black beachgoers, and this led to a conflagration, right? And so we're in a summer, this is when these things happen, mm-hmm. And like in 1919, we've been pent up with the stay-at-home orders, and that's part of it. But what I want to stress is that with these, unlike our dominant riot history, which has been a riot history to preserve the racial order, what we see here are multiracial crowds protesting for racial justice. And that's the flip that needs to go off, the switch that needs to go off in the minds of the political class, particularly in the Democratic Party, because these people are the future voters, the future dominant voters of our society. And that's why the Republicans behave the way that they do. They're terrified of these changes. And this is what explains Mr. Trump's stance toward it.
You know, if it's, and I'm afraid we've only got a little less than a minute left in our conversation, and there's so much more we could be talking about, but I wonder, I mean, you're used to having to, as a professor, explain things to large groups of people, but if it's not too personal to ask, how are you handling your emotions related to another police murder of a black man?
Well, Well, I've been in this business a long time, and it's always hard. But, you know, I'm of that generation that integrated America. I helped integrate my neighborhood, integrated my bus stop. I myself am a lynching survivor. I chose this work because this is the work that I want to do to promote change. But the videos make it a lot harder. The videos are an assault on mental health. And it's profoundly sad when those videos hit our streams. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that these young people in the streets are going to make change. I'm just hopeful that the old people in Washington will give them the support that they need.
Professor Alvin Tillery teaches political science and African American studies at Northwestern University, where he is also the head of the Center for Study of Diversity and Democracy. Professor Tillery, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us.